Welcome to the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast. I'm John, Father John Deere, and today I'm speaking with my friend Brian McLaren, author, theologian, and scripture scholar, about the topic Following the Nonviolent Jesus in a Time of Rising Authoritarianism. This podcast is a project of www.beatitudecenter.org, where you can find many other podcasts and regular Zoom programs on the nonviolence of Jesus and practicing nonviolence and working for a more just, more peaceful world. So I'd like to begin with a little two-second prayer. So I invite everyone who's listening to just take a deep breath wherever you are and just relax and recenter yourself. And together, let's enter into the presence of the God of peace who loves you infinitely and personally and everyone. And let's welcome the gentle, nonviolent Jesus here with us and take a moment to ask for the grace to follow the nonviolent Jesus more faithfully and do God's will. God of peace, thank you for all the blessings of life, love, and peace that you give us. Be with us now as we reflect on the nonviolence of Jesus in this time of authoritarianism, oligarchy, fascism, death, destruction, and global collapse. Bless us, inspire us, disarm us, strengthen us, and send us to do your will and proclaim your way of peace, love, and nonviolence, that we might all do our part to help end war and poverty, violence, racism, greed, oligarchy, nuclear weapons, and environmental destruction, that we might better follow the nonviolent Jesus and be your beatitude people of universal love, universal compassion, and universal peace. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, it's my great pleasure today to welcome my friend Brian McLaren to reflect with us on following the nonviolent Jesus in a time of rising authoritarianism. And so with the growth of Christian nationalism, oligarchy, fascism, here at home under the Trump administration, with the Republican Party and Fox News, as well as around the world, it's really great to welcome you, Brian, to help us understand the nonviolent Jesus in light of this, how he dealt with it in his day and how we can respond today. Brian McLaren is, I think, one of the greatest scripture scholars and theologians in the world. He spent 24 years as a pastor in a local congregation in Washington, D.C., and his life and ministry changed when, as a young evangelical pastor, he realized that he was called to be a follower of Jesus, not simply a follower of the Bible or a theological system or religious hierarchy. And wow, Brian, doesn't that make all the difference? For the last 25 years, this is why I identify with Brian. As an author, public speaker, teacher, and activist, he's been, quote, taking Jesus public. I love that, Brian. And exploring how the life and message of Jesus relate to issues of personal and public life today. That's why I'm so happy to welcome you to the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast. Let me just give you a little plug about your books. Brian's Dean of the Faculty for the Center of Action and Contemplation. And you may not know, Brian, but we just had on Richard Rohr talking about his
name. I loved the conversation.
And then Brian has his own podcast called Learning How to See and is co-host of Southern Lights. He's written a number of great bestsellers. Here are a few. Recent ones are Faith After Doubt, Do I Stay Christian, Life After Doom, Wisdom and Courage for a World Falling Apart, Everything Must Change, which is about the Kingdom of God, Finding Our Way, about spiritual formation, and this great title, Why Did Jesus, Moses, the Buddha, and Muhammad Cross the Road? Now, Brian, it's hard to take you seriously with the title. Like, no, that's just brilliant. Brian is a world-renowned speaker and lecturer in churches and conferences everywhere. He's married to Grace. They have 4 adult children, 5 grandchildren. He's coming to us from Florida, where he lives, and he has an amazing website with all his books. Do check it out. It's at brianmclaren.net. Brian, thanks for being with me today.
Well, hey, John, I love any chance I get to be in conversation with you. And thanks for all those kind words. I fall far below them. So we should ask everybody to lower their expectations.
Not at all. Brian, we're going to jump right into the deep end. So everybody buckle your seatbelts. So here we are, right in the thick of it, with the Trump administration crushing the poor, building oligarchy, spreading idolatry and Christian nationalism, and fascism, like the Nazis, using Fox News as a propaganda, and the churches and masses going right along with it. Yes. And this has been going on, of course, for decades or centuries, but it's really coming to a head now. And basically creating disorder so that the 1% can get richer and the rest of the nation and the world can collapse. And recently, Brian, you wrote a second short ebook on authoritarianism called The Second Pandemic, which I haven't had a chance to see. So let's start with that. Tell us, what is authoritarianism, and what are your reflections from your book about what's happening?
Well, I should tell you first, way back in 2015 and 2016, when Donald Trump was gaining steam, remember, first by promoting birther conspiracies and so on, I just had this feeling something ugly and weird and psychological and sociopathic and all was going on here. And I called a few psychologists and neuroscientist friends of mine, and I said, look, send me any articles you can that will help, that are peer-reviewed or you think they're trustworthy and accurate, that will help me understand what was going on. And they started doing that. I started doing some of my own research, and that was the genesis of this little ebook. And I put together a little definition of authoritarianism. I could share that. That might be a good place for us to start.
Yeah.
Authoritarianism is a process of centralizing power in an individual, party, or cabal. Cabal just means a group of individuals, militia, religious leaders, powerful oligarchs, and so on. So it's a process of centralizing power in an individual, party, or cabal. And here's how they do it: by using fear of a real or concocted enemy. But fear is the special sauce. Radical division of society based on support for the regime. So radical division of society based on support for the regime, and then gross distortion of or diversion from the truth, and then finally suppression of dissent. Fear, division, distortion or diversion from the truth, and suppression of dissent. And that describes a phenomenon that comes up again and again and again in human history. And we happen to be born at a time when the conditions were right for this to happen again.
Wow, that's well put. And we're living all of that right now as never before in the United States. So you and I are interested in the wisdom and practicalities of active creative nonviolence and nonviolent resistance as taught by Gandhi and King as a way to understand Jesus. But tell me about nonviolent responses in general to authoritarianism. And you say in your ebook that one of the key things to be prepared to respond nonviolently. I mean, we got to do something. We can't sit back and write. We have, maybe you could talk about that too. But you said in particular to learn about biases and prejudice and how that's used to manipulate us. And that's all intentional.
Yes, exactly right. Well, first, John, let me say, you know, for you and I who are followers of the nonviolent Jesus, when you look at Jesus, he's like the absolute inverse of an authoritarian leader. Instead of using fear, he invites people toward faith, hope, and love. Instead of radically dividing society, he creates tables and spaces where we welcome everybody and we show love and respect for everybody. Instead of gross distortion of and diversion from the truth, he consistently spoke the truth, even when it was painful. And he often understood that if he spoke the truth directly, nobody would even listen. So he often spoke the truth indirectly through parables and other masterful communication techniques to get around the biases that are so deeply ingrained in people. And then instead of the suppression of dissent, he was an agent of dissent. He organized public demonstrations to show an alternative, non-authoritarian, non-violent way of life.
That is so beautifully helpful, the way you put that. I wasn't expecting that. And I wish we could talk about that for the rest of our lives, but go on. I just want to say thank you for saying that. He's the opposite of authoritarianism. And he shows that God is the opposite of authoritarianism.
Yes, exactly.
We have a nonviolent God. Jesus is nonviolent.
By stooping to wash the feet of his disciples, suddenly you see why Peter in that story got so upset. You know, this expression of power made no sense to him, the power of nonviolence, the power of service, the power of humility. And that's why I think Jesus said, hey, look, if you can't be part of this, you're not part of the thing I'm doing. I'm doing something that's such a different approach to leadership. Let me mention one other thing before we move on, and that is, after World War II, a lot of people started asking the obvious question: how could educated Europe, how could so-called civilized Europe, especially Germany, fall into the trap of authoritarianism? And so a whole lot of people started theorizing about it, historical research and psychological research. And there was a Canadian social psychologist named Bob Altmaier who did a huge amount of research on authoritarians. And this feature of his research, I think, is useful for us to know when we look around at our world today. He found that in every culture that he studied, about 30% of people had what he called authoritarian personalities. This didn't mean they wanted to be authoritarian leaders. It meant that if you put them under enough stress, if you put them under stress or shame, they were desperate for a strong man to come and rescue them. And so they became susceptible because of their response to stress and shame. They became susceptible to those tactics of authoritarianism. And understanding that, first of all, helps me have mercy on people around me. If I think this is just a feature of a lot of people, and they're susceptible. And so when conditions get bad enough, they're the first who they can't help it. It's like if you don't have immunity to a disease and a disease comes through, you're the first to become, the first to succumb. And that helps me have a little mercy on people. And then maybe helps me think a little more about how we're going to get our messages through. And that's where the research on bias came in. Here's one way to say it. Authoritarians have this ability. It sounds terrible. They have like an anti-spiritual gift of lying. and their lies fall in two categories, or many categories, I'm sure, but two main ones. One is they tell you what you want to hear. So if you feel ashamed, they tell you it's not your fault, it's somebody else's fault. If you feel afraid, they tell you, well, look, I can fix it all. It'll be easy. So they tell you what you want to hear. And then the second thing they do is they bombard you with so many lies that you stop believing you can even know what the truth is. And in a certain way, they help you bypass your own critical thinking, so you subcontract out your thinking to the authoritarian and his allies. So you put all that together, and that's why I think a podcast like this is so important. We need to go to places that help us sort of get a different leverage point so we don't succumb to the barrage of lies and all the other psychological manipulations that could suck us into trouble.
How do we do that? I think that means, well, for me, I don't watch the news. I only read stuff, and I encourage people not to listen to Fox News in particular because it's an organized propaganda. But a lot of the news is, and also I'm I'm really trying to get the truth from the Gospels and the peacemakers and the movements around the world. What do you think? How can we educate ourselves against these biases and being trained to believe lies, really?
Yeah. Well, listen, let me say two things for starters, and then we'll see where we want to go. First, to me, this is just a sign of a terrible shortfall of the church of the last couple generations.
Yeah.
The Christian faith ought to be a place that's educating people. How many times did Jesus say, you have ears, but you don't hear?
I know.
Or take heed how you hear. Yeah. He constantly told us that we ought to listen with critical thinking, with discernment. And our churches have just left us sitting ducks for this. Or often our churches, in a certain sense, have had their own form of religious authoritarianism that then sets us up for political authoritarianism. Not only that, but our current authoritarianism isn't just military and political leaders. It's also the world's most, the richest billionaires, the oligarchs. And so you put them in the picture, and they control media. They own, they control the algorithms. And you just realize there is so much working against us. We need communities that will help us undo the brainwashing, let's say it that way. And if we can find it in our churches, and sadly many of our churches have just, you know, they haven't shown up for duty, that's when we find suddenly what Jesus said makes sense. If two or three of you gather in my name, if you gather to be part of my work of peace, if you gather in the whole identity that I'm manifesting in the world, this anti-authoritarian identity, two or three of you get together, I'll be there with you. You'll be able to get some vantage points, some guidance, some comfort, some stability. And so that's what I think we need. And in some ways, that's what a podcast like this does. It creates a space in the privacy of someone's car or earphones where they can hear a different perspective.
Well, you said where we go with all this. So we're going to, I want to spend our time talking about Jesus. But one last thought about all of this is, you know, that I totally agree with you that I think the Gospel of John, which is written long after the Synoptics, actually kind of comes out and says it. Hey, the problem is not the rest of the world. It's you followers aren't doing what I'm telling you to do. It's the church. And John was trying to tell that. So I never could understand what happened in Germany and the Nazis, and I've been studying it too. And then you read Bonhoeffer and what he was up against with the Protestant churches, or my friend Gordon Zahn, who wrote an early book called German Catholics and Hitler's Wars. And I remember, Brian, my mom, when I was young, mailed me a picture she found once. All the Catholic bishops and cardinals of Germany around 1937, in full regalia, with Hitler in the center, all wearing swastikas and all holding champagne glasses, and all of them with Hitler smiling. And that has stayed with me for my whole life, because that's it. And all of that's playing out now in the United States, certainly in the Catholic Church, as the bishops and priests are blindly following this oligarchy. So there we have that, and, you know, I guess I never really thought I'd live to experience that like they did, poor Bonhoeffer and others suffered in Germany, and we're going through that, of course.
Yeah.
And so that's why I'm talking about the nonviolent Jesus and looking toward him, because I don't think there's any other way to help us out of our insanity. So I guess my question, and then do you agree with all of that? And then tell me about the nonviolent Jesus and how he responded to the authoritarianism of his day. You already did it well, but go to town on it.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, yes, everything you said just resonates deeply. And that image of church leaders toasting or drinking wine and having a merry time with Hitler, of course, we have seen so many corollaries to that in recent years, and they turn the stomach and they break the heart, and they just force us to say, you know, things 5 years ago, 10 years ago, things were not as good as we might have thought, because unsolved problems and unaddressed issues that took a long time to develop brought us to this place. So what we're experiencing now didn't pop out of nowhere. This is the result of unaddressed issues for a long time. So when I think about what happens here and what does the nonviolent Jesus, his life and teaching, say to us at a time like this, the first thing I'd say is, we have got to find places where we can actually talk about the nonviolent Jesus. You might remember the Episcopal Bishop Marianne Buddy when she just called for mercy. Yeah. A pretty Christ-like thing to do, right? Yeah. And the people who most viciously attacked her were conservative Christians, right? And they called her names and called her of the devil and all kinds of things. So we have to realize it's not even safe in many of our Christian communities. And I think we're going to have to consciously find the people who we can speak freely with and who share a diagnosis of the trouble we're in. And not only do we gather to help ourselves keep sane and follow the nonviolent path, but it helps us go into the world with a spirit of nonviolence. You know, I live here in Florida where support for Trump is super, super high. But what I've noticed in the last couple of weeks, really, since the new year, and especially since the inauguration, I'm noticing people going out of their way to be kind. And I know these are the people who aren't happy with what's happening. I was at the Episcopal Church that I attend Sunday, and there's an African-American fellow who helps us with our sound, all of our sound equipment. And I noticed a number of white people came over and went out of their way to say hi to him and make a connection with him. And I thought to myself, as they're watching this ugly white supremacy be coddled under this regime, they know we're in trouble, and they're going out of their way to try through small acts of kindness to make a difference. And I think that's loving our neighbors is not a small thing, according to the nonviolent Jesus. Mm. Walking across the road to help the guy who's been thrown in the ditch is not a small thing. Mm. And so I think those become ways that we begin. There's a lot more we could say about resistance and so on in times like this, but and I think we all have to be preparing ourselves I think we have to let some of the worst case scenarios run through our minds as miserable and horrible as that is, so that we can say, if that starts to happen, what are we going to do? And that's where having some people to talk about this together really makes a difference.
Well, tell me just a couple of, you said that beautifully at the beginning there about Jesus, that little summation, a few more concrete, any more things about Jesus, whether things he said, his teachings, or his examples that we can use to respond nonviolently to this rising authoritarianism.
Yes. Well, we already spoke about Bishop Marianne Buddy, and what we all may find, we all might not have a stage like she had that day that was televised and so on, but we will find places where someone says something shabby, someone says something racist, someone says something harmful. And if we're prepared at that moment, we can just speak up. I try to give people a little script that I think can help even the least experienced and least confident of us have a starting place. And that is, when we hear someone say something harmful about our immigrant brothers and sisters, or something harmful about people of a minority race or religion, or heartless and callous about Gaza or something like that, that we just say, hey, I need you to know, I see that differently. My little 5-word script is, wow, I see that differently. And almost any time I have, a friend of mine calls this the courage to differ graciously. Hmm. And almost any time I speak up and differ graciously, boldly, but graciously, wow, I see that differently. Not, wow, you're really ignorant, which is just going to create a battle of ego.
Yeah, that's been my style over the years. That's well, beautiful. I see that differently. That's very helpful and nonviolent teaching. What else, especially from Jesus, do you see that we could try?
Well, And this is where when Jesus says, "Let your yes be yes and your no be no." Yes. Sometimes we just have to be clear. It's as simple as raising our hand, or as you're saying, "I need you to know I don't go along with that. I need you to know I see that differently." Almost always, people will then follow up, "Well, what do you mean?" And here's something I've learned in private social situations: if there's a group of people witnessing a conversation or a confrontation like this, the person we're standing up to or standing up in opposition to what they've said, they're now going to perform, and it won't be a good opportunity for real communication. It's an opportunity for this person to perform and show how he's a good soldier of his cause. So what I often will say is, the important thing is, I need you to know I see it differently. If you're interested in knowing why, you, or then you turn to the other people around, or any of you, just ask me in private, and I'd love to tell you. Now, sometimes a public confrontation is necessary, as with Bishop Buddy, but often when people come to us in private, so many of Jesus' conversations, you know, they happen in private, because if we really want to help people change, sometimes we need them to take the first step to come to us and to not be performing for others. I suppose that's why Nicodemus came to Jesus at night in the Gospel of John. You know, he had to get out of the performance mode so there could be a real connection.
That's brilliant. Okay, I want to ask you about the public mode then. And so I am talking with you now, and then the following podcast will be with our friend. We're going to continue this theme with our friend Shane Claiborne, and then I'm going to do a podcast on Luke 10 as a way to respond. And I want your thoughts about that. My take is that Jesus is, Brian, I always joke in public, Jesus thinks he's Gandhi. He thinks he's Martin Luther King. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that. But anyway, he's doing all this great stuff, and he's doing the one-on-one, but he really wrecks it. It says in Luke 9, verse 51, he turned, and the verse is, he turned and set his face to Jerusalem. Like, okay, I'm dealing with this. And then he forms a movement under, according to Luke 10. He sends 72 ahead, lambs in the midst of wolves. You're to speak out about the coming of the reign of God. He gets to, it's a movement, just like Gandhi's Salt March. He gets to Jerusalem, he breaks down sobbing, and he doesn't give up there. He then goes in and does nonviolent direct action, civil disobedience in the temple. You're going to be killed in 24 hours, and he is. How do we engage in public nonviolent action and resistance to this rising authoritarian? And I think it's going to mean everybody's got to get involved in the movement, that old phrase, all hands on deck. But I want to hear what you think about that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. The thing that's so challenging right now is that we aren't sure the lay of the land that we're going to face. And I think we're dealing with a more complex situation than we were when you and I got arrested back in the 1990s together. Because now we have this coalition of the richest oligarchs in the world and the most powerful government in the world with the most lethal weapons in the world, and the government that is defying concern for the earth with a brazenness and a stupidity that's just hard to, you can't over estimate what the damage that's going to be done to the earth under this administration. So you put all of that together, and I think we're all going to have to keep our eyes open and listen for the people who are organizing. And, you know, anything you organize, I want to be part of, because I trust you so much. And those of us who are organizing together, and we're going to have to keep our ears open for the right time to do the right thing. That's, you know, there beautiful. Are times when Jesus is in the middle of a huge crowd and he disappears from the crowd. I think he knows this is not the right time for me to get killed quite yet, you know. And it's not because he's afraid. It's because he has a strategy. But when the time comes, he goes to Jerusalem and basically says, okay, this is it. This is time for the life or death confrontation.
So you mentioned the church and the failures of the church, and I put it down to very, very clearly year 315, Constantine the Emperor theoretically converts and makes Christianity, which is an illegal, underground, evil movement, as far as the empire is concerned, makes it legal, says you can no longer have to practice the Sermon on the Mount and nonviolence. You can all be Roman soldiers. And the next thing you know, we got the just war theory, and here we are. Well, a lot of good people are still, there's people still staying with the church, like you and I. And you've been doing this for years. And in light of all this, my question would be, you know, what can people do to help their local church and even the broader church move more toward the nonviolent Jesus? And I never heard anybody talk about that beautiful teaching, two or three are gathered. So any other thoughts for good people who are staying in the church about what we can do now to help move the church?
Well, you know, let me give a couple very specific things. I was a pastor for 24 years. If you go to your priest or your pastor in private and without making threats or with the most compassionate heart you can, to go to your priest or pastor and say, could you give me an idea of where you stand in what's going on with our government right now and with this resurgence of white supremacy and this carelessness toward the poor and this cavalier attitude toward the earth and so on. Could you give me an idea of where you stand? And the priest or pastor, and say to them, I'm not going to judge you. I just really want to know, right? And then the priest or pastor might say, well, where do you stand? And then you can share. What that allows you to do is to say, and you might even say, listen, if I were to try to organize people in our church to be thinking about this and facing these issues, for example, they might say, I'd like to use Father John Deere's book on the nonviolent Jesus and his reading of the Gospels for a book study, or we'd like to listen to John Deere's podcast and have a discussion on it every week or something like that. Would that be okay with you? What would be ways, like, could I organize this through the church? Or should I just do it privately with some friends? In other words, you don't give the priest or pastor permission to tell you what you can or can't do privately, but you can see how much room there is for you in the church. If I were a pastor and someone came to me with that spirit, it would do a couple of things. It would let me know first, if I'm not happy about what's going on, I have somebody here who could back me up, and maybe I'll have a little more courage. And if they aren't going to be supportive, it just lets you know you're going to have to, obviously you work through your network of relationships. It just won't be able to be formally through the real estate of the church, perhaps.
So many people have walked away from their ministers and priests. They remain in the church, but they don't dialogue with them. And for my whole life, I've seen that's not it. That's not love. Yeah. Okay. Anybody can be angry. To go and talk to them and give them gifts, and because they're all poor people who are failing of Jesus, we all know it. And I think what you say is so helpful, and I'm glad you're seeing it. And, Oscar Romero, I heard this from the Jesuits who were killed in El Salvador. They hated him. He was about as worse as you can get. And everybody wrote him off except for one Jesuit, Rutilio Grande. And when he was shot and killed, Romero did a 180 and became maybe the greatest bishop who ever lived in history. And it's only because somebody reached out to him, Rutilio. Yeah. And I think that's a parable for us here in the U.S. I don't mean to give a speech, but we've used up our time, so let me end with one last question. Any last words of hope and encouragement as we wrap this up for our listeners, Brian?
Well, John, one of the things that Jesus said and did, especially near the end of his public ministry, he didn't tell people everything's going to be fine next week. He didn't even tell them, look, Friday's going to be bad, but everything will be fine on Sunday. He didn't give them false hope. And this actually gives me a deeper hope when I'm prepared to face the fact that things might get worse, and then they might get worse, and then they might get worse. When I realize that, it then makes me say, I need to wake up to the full gravity of our situation, and I need to decide how I want to show up in these times. And to me, that's the deepest question that here at my age, I'll be 70 soon, and I just keep finding myself saying, how do I want to show up? This is my one and only life. How do I want to show up? And that, and just asking the question helps us be decisive and proactive rather than fearful and reactive. And of course, if we've committed our hearts to the nonviolent Jesus, then of course we now have a direction where we've set our face to go in as well.
Wow, that's so beautiful, Brian. Thank you so much, Brian McLaren, for speaking with me today and encouraging all of us to commit our hearts, like more than ever now, no matter how old we are, to the nonviolent Jesus and the will of God, and just say, right, we're getting on with living the gospel. So thanks, friends, for listening to this podcast, and you can hear more podcasts and find other upcoming Zoom programs at www.beatitudecenter.org. And please consider offering a donation to support this free work. And if you can, please leave some positive feedback or review at NCR or Apple or Spotify or whatever platform you use. Join me next week as we continue these questions and themes with our activist and lecturer, our great friend, Shane Claiborne. May the God of peace bless everyone. Keep on following the nonviolent Jesus. See you all next time.